Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, and today we're talking about food biographies, not a person biography, but a food biography of a city. And of course, cities, all big cities, certainly around this country and in other countries around the world, have a special story about their own food, and they have their specialty dishes. But it seems to me, maybe I'm biased, but no one has quite the story that New York has.
Absolutely true.
And today I have with me, you hear this booming voice, I have Andrew Smith with me today to talk about New York City food. Andy has just published a book called New York City, A Food Biography. I didn't make that up. That was okay. It's already made up. Andy has been teaching food studies courses at the New School University since 95, and he's the author and or editor of over 25 books to date. Are we clicking off a couple more and still counting?
What's today?
Right, okay. And some of those are, they're fabulous. They're all sort of biographies in a way of a food or a culinary historical dining experience. And this one, of course, is near and dear to my heart, being New York City food. But certainly it resonates with cities around the country as they started to develop and grow. But
yeah, this is one book of a series of food biographies of other cities.
And Ken Albala is the editor of this series.
Is a general editor. The San Francisco one has been published. New Orleans has been published, and there are several more under contract.
So. New Orleans, that should be very interesting.
It's a fascinating idea.
Yeah. And as I said, every city's got their own little story to tell, and certainly their food specialty items. This is very fascinating to me because there are things that just surprised me, took me totally by surprise. But you tell me about what in particular let's talk about New York's food. What makes New York's food so special? We'd have to go back and talk about what are the specialties of New York. Now, you start at the very beginning, the prehistory.
And that's one of the things that really fascinated me. I spent a great deal more time and space on the early prehistory of New York City simply because the geography of the city is extremely important. It's location, location, location is the answer. And part of it is New York City has a deep water port, and for early New Amsterdam and early colonial New York City, and for early New York City in non-colonial times, the deep water port meant that you could bring huge sailing ships right up to Manhattan. You could put a dock right there and do it. There's no other port on the East Coast that is a deep water port. So consequently, New York City ends up as the trading capital of early America. And then the completion of the Erie Canal. Mm-hmm. As soon as the Erie Canal is completed in 1825, you have massive amounts of grain lots of it had been coming in through the Hudson anyway, but now coming in first from upstate New York and then from the Midwest. And not only is food coming here, you also have money coming happening here. And once you've got money and you've got a lot of food, then you've got cuisine.
That's
And to me, those are some of the things that I knew before I started writing the book, but I was really surprised at how important geography was, how important climate was.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the railway system then was developed, and who started it was right here in New York with the big money.
And, you know. And railroads in part went along the canal routes. And so, and so you've got this whole transportation system from shipping to canals to railroads that makes a huge difference in early history.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners probably are not aware of some of the early history of New York's food scene, and not knowing that New York was vastly underwater for a large period of time. We won't go back that far. I don't think we have to go back to the Ice Age. But
it wasn't even underwater. I mean, it was under ice. And the ocean itself was 200 or 300 miles out to the east. That doesn't surprise you. It shocked me. I just hadn't expected that. And the fact that New York City was the end of the terminal rain for the glacier that came down. And virtually all of Staten Island and Long Island are the remains of debris that was pushed down from what's today New England. So those are some of the things that surprised me.
So when the shift of the plates, of the land plates, finally took place. But
the land plates didn't move. It was the rising and falling of the ocean due to the fact that there was so much water on land, not just in North America, but also in Europe. So you just had shifts and changes of ocean and climate.
And what we were left with, New York, was a great wealth of seafood.
It was an incredible oasis for not only seafood, but for birds. There were tens of thousands of different types of birds that came through here, and some of them moved in the billions of categories, like the passenger pigeon, and their claims that when that flew overhead, you couldn't see the sun. I'm not sure how true those were, but there were a lot of birds that came through here. And then, of course, the migratory fish, and then the deer and buffalo were here, which I don't know if they were actually in what is today New York City, but they were very close by. And I always thought of the buffalo as Plains Indians, and I didn't really realize that they were here.
Yeah. So food sources were plentiful.
Food sources were plentiful, and for the first the Paleo Indians hunting woolly mammoths, and for the Lenape Indians that were here, I mean, it was you didn't really have to work that hard. The food was easily accessible throughout the year.
On oysters, right?
Well, the oyster story to me also, I was aware of, for a variety of reasons, but the estimates vary between 20% to 50% of the world's oysters were here in the New York City, either the Bay or the area that's around the city, and I find that incredible. And of course, they were by far one of the most important foods of earlier New York, all the way up until the end of the 19th century.
Yeah, I mean, you can see a lot of old photographs and drawings, line drawings of vendors on the corner selling with a big barrel of oysters.
You didn't even need a ship. All you needed was a rake and just go into, I mean, what you think of now is there's land and then there's water, but historically there would have been a huge wetland in which you could go into. You could just rake up and get the, and so if you were hungry, you could just go out and get some oysters. And if you need a little money, not a problem. You just go and rake a little more up.
Get a barrel and sell them, right?
And you'd sell them. And those stories are great, but also, what's exciting to me about the oyster story is it was consumed by the poor as well as by the wealthy, and in the same place at the same time. And that was one of the few things that really brought all classes of New York City together at the same time.
It's interesting. That's right. They're all eating the same food from the same cart, from the same vendor. Interesting. What surprised me was caviar. That New York was a large producer of caviar.
The largest supplier of caviar in the late 19th
century. No, they didn't
produce
it, right, the supplier.
But there was not a lot of demand for it in New York City, but it was exported. But the sturgeon, the massive number of sturgeon that went up and down the Hudson River was also another incredible, you know, people made the claim you could walk across the Hudson River during the time that they were spawning, blah, 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 blah. Not true, but it's a nice story. But the fact is that the sturgeon were plentiful here. As were shad. I mean, you went down the list, and were mammals. The whales came into the bay, and they do occasionally now. now, but historically they would have been here on a regular basis. And all other sea life that you could think of was available in the area.
Interesting. What dish or types of food really caught the attention your attention as you were writing this? When we're talking, let's say, early 19th century.
Early 19th century. Mm-hmm. Well, there wasn't a lot in early 19th century. Mid 19th century is when immigrants come in, and then New York City becomes a really exciting place. It's this mix, and it's not just the ethnic national foods that people bring in. It's the fact that most Americans didn't like the ethnic or national foods that immigrants brought in, and so the immigrants had to change them and change the types of foods that they had in order to attract mainstream New Yorkers or New Yorkers from other ethnic groups. And so you end up with these crossovers that were based on culinary traditions from the old country, but had something very different and something unique that I think is one of the more important things about New York City. And to me, that's one of the things that continue 150 years later is still a very important part of New York City.
That's right. Of course, now we're more open to embracing those cuisines as soon as they...
Today we look forward, man, Korean tacos on the street, let's go for it.
Right,
So it's this crossover of which in the countries themselves, the chefs and cooks would never have had contact with different groups. And so in one sense, it's not just the ethnic foods that are here, it is the combination of foods.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about that immigration period. Surprising, I think, to many people would be to know who was the first and largest group of immigrants.
Oh, from the beginning, there were immigrants here. And if you ask me, what was I surprised at? When England took over New Amsterdam in 1664, more than half of the colony weren't Dutch. And many of
they
the
were
Dutch,
not Dutch.
They were not Dutch. They were English. There was an Italian here. I didn't think of those things. I always thought, well, this is Dutch, and we know exactly what the Dutch ate. And the answer is we don't know what they ate. But there was a huge diversity of people here, even from the beginning. And so you had immigration and immigrants coming in during that period. But the first massive wave begins in the 1830s and is Germans. And Germans will continue to come for the next almost 100 years. And so you have this massive number of Germans, and the German influence today, where is it, Peter? Peter Luger's? There are some German restaurants here, but 100 years ago, German restaurants would have been all over the place. And delicatessens, of course, are a German retail operation that then shift over time into the delis that we know and love today, the Jewish delis or the Korean delis that they have. But they're very, very different than what originally the delicatessen was.
And the beer halls. I mean, I think you have a picture in the book. There was William Grimes did a wonderful book, and he has a large chapter about the first restaurants and the German beer halls. Humongous.
Yes, there were many floors with bands and bowling alleys and pool tables and actual gardens indoor gardens in New York City that you could go and drink beer. You take your family to them. I mean, it wasn't something like saloons at the time or bars that were basically all male, but you could take a family to a nice German.
Beer garden,
yeah. and have a great time, and it was you'd spend a day there, and you'd be entertained, and you would have a good time, and so that's so different than the current bar scene of New York City.
Although we are seeing a few beer gardens pop up again,
and
I know one in particular, and they even have events for families and mothers and children in the afternoons. I mean, they're really trying to become this family oriented business. So it all goes back again, right?
On the beer side to it, New York, of course, had breweries to begin with, but the breweries didn't do well in Manhattan in particular because of the water. I mean, there was lots of problems with water. So it isn't until the Croton Aqueduct is completed in the 1840s that you begin to have a huge supply of fresh water that you could have breweries. And so the number of breweries in New York City were incredible. Of course, the breweries disappeared during Prohibition, and they come back after Prohibition, they lose market share to breweries in the Midwest. But today there are 10 breweries, working breweries in New York City. And that's a great story. It's not just the past. It's also the new things that are going on. There are more than 1,000 food startups in New York City today. And that's an incredible story.
That is an incredible story.
A lot of them are little mom and pop shops that are opening up. Others are in buildings together with other startups. And it's, to me, a very exciting food scene, not just the restaurants, which everybody talks about, but it's also the production of food that's continuing in New York City in new ways.
Well, talking about little startups, food startups, what were some of those that really made waves in the early days of New York that really put something on the map as being New York?
Sugar. Do you think of New York City as being the sugar capital of at least of the United States? For those of us that know Williamsburg, yes, of course.
Other than going by and seeing that domino sign.
We all know that domino sign. But from about the 1830s on, New York City became the major sugar refinery, not just of North, but of the entire country. And by the late 19th century, it controlled something like 80% of the total refined sugar in the United States. You don't think of New York as a sugar refinery.
No, definitely not.
Place. And the Domino's factory only closed in 2004. So although obviously the share of the market dwindled, but it was still there until very recently.
Well, again, the shipping and bringing the raw product in at, that helped to be, geography.
Geography. Historically, it made a lot of sense because what you didn't want to do with a sailing ship is produce your end product, your refined sugar in Jamaica, and then move on a sailing ship with lots of humidity and water to another place because you have to refine it anyway. So they would do a preliminary refining in the place where the sugar cane was grown, and then it would be imported to cities, whether it be New York City or London or Amsterdam or any one of the other cities, and then you do your refining there, and that's what happened for almost 400 years.
Well, in New York, New York had a lot of firsts, of course, and those firsts traveled across the country. But let's talk about some of the firsts. And as I said, once again, a food that put itself on the map and became kind of a New York food, and I'm thinking of something like a hot dog.
Well, hot dogs are a fascinating story. Again, it's the street vendor story, which I had general knowledge on, but that was one of the things that really surprised me a great deal, is how street vendors affected not only food in New York City, but food around the United States. And the hot dog is a good example. I could find no other previous reference to anybody in the United States getting a sausage and putting a bun around it and eating it. And at least from a popularization standpoint, that clearly happens in Coney Island, and it is Coney Island hot dog that is popularized, and that will begin hot dogs in America. So it's a street vendor that starts it off, and you can't sell a sausage if you're a street vendor. How do you hold it?
Yeah.
So they put a bun around the outside. Okay, let's do that. That to me was one of the fascinating stories.
Yeah. Is there anything that people would be surprised at knowing that it started in New York?
Snapple. Did you realize Snapple starts in
Brooklyn? Well, yeah, because I knew who the guys were. But
there are large numbers of companies that were based here at some point and then moved on. Pepsi Cola was based here. Mm-hmm. No one thinks of Pepsi Cola, but there's a plant in New York City from Pepsi Cola, and it was the headquarters for a long period of time. And you start looking at a lot of the other products. Nabisco is the great story. Oreo cookies. Yeah. We're talking real New York. And then
thinks of Oreo cookies as a New York
food. No, they lose the true heritage and history. As soon as they move production elsewhere, that's it. But Chelsea Market was the headquarters for Nabisco. And of course, for those of us who love New York food, Malamars.
How can you
not have a Malamar? And that's the same product that came out of Nabisco, as did Animal Crackers. Remember Animal Crackers?
Yeah. Now, see, that was the other thing I was surprised at, that Animal Crackers were a New York product.
But they're actually, I didn't go through the whole history on it.
Okay,
but technically they're English, and they come over to America, and the Americans then recreate the idea. But the idea is the animal crackers that we know and love with the little box
Barnum
that we
and
all
Bailey,
had with Barnum
you know,
and Bailey were here.
What about black and white cookies? I didn't see them. What? Do you know anything about those?
They're mentioned in here. I couldn't figure out where they started, but obviously something that is a tradition for New York City and one of which is very popular. So, there were a lot of other products that came out and then moved on, for a variety of reasons.
All right. And of course, talking about immigration, we know that because of the great influx of different ethnic people and foods, that we then have bagels and
yes.
cream cheese and lox and the
and
smoked
pastrami.
Fishes and pastrami.
Yeah.
Right. And New York, of course, Montreal would argue that, between bagels and pastrami, they're kings and we're second.
They may be kings, but from an historical standpoint, they started here.
We had it first.
The best historical evidence currently uncovered, and now who knows, those people in Montreal, they may come up with something. But New York really is the beginning of what we think of as bagels. Yes, there are traditions that come in from Eastern Europe and come in here, but the bagel we know and love today is really an adaptation of those traditions. And,
right.
and it's something that becomes popular throughout America. And I've never seen Bialy's outside of New York City. I'm sure they're there, but that's it. And when I have a bagel in another city, I'm sorry to say, it's embarrassing. It's an embarrassment.
And can you? And what date do you pinpoint that at? Anything?
Bagels are clearly late 19th century, 1860s, 1870s, and as are pretzels, by the way. And there's this big argument now with pretzels, with Pennsylvania and Philadelphia.
That's
whether,
right.
Whether there's now this Philadelphia pretzel shop in Brooklyn. I just want you to know, I can't tell the difference between there, and they will not hand out the recipe, but I can't tell the difference between that and a New York pretzel. But that's an interesting. Fair argument.
There are some other firsts that we're going to talk about too, and we'll do that as soon as we come back from a short break. I didn't mean to.
You're listening to Something to Believe In by Four Lincolns on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow, with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point of origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past. I'm talking with Andy Smith about his new book, New York City, A Food Biography. And Andy, we talked about different foods that got their start here in New York on the streets mostly, but there was really no place, boarding houses came. There are no such thing as restaurants. People can listen to one of my past shows on restaurants and the advent of restaurants, but Restaurants were non-existent. There were boarding houses, places to go and eat if you had to travel and stay. But there were some enterprising brothers who started something. Tell me about that.
Delmonico's, right? Well, there are dining rooms in hotels prior to that time, and so it gets a little confusing because what's the difference between dining?
What's
room
a restaurant? And what's dining? And right.
Delmonico's creates the first independent restaurant, which is the model that all other restaurants, first in New York City and then around the country, will follow. And it's a place where you can go in, get a menu, you can order from that menu. You don't get just one thing that the restaurant serves at a particular time, and then you pay one bill at the end of the meal. So at least that's the basic definition of what a restaurant is.
Which I think for a lot of listeners, it will strike them as coming relatively late.
Yes, 1830s is when this idea will begin in America. Now, we will start in France before that, mm-hmm. and it will start in other countries. But in the United States, Delmonico's from the 1830s is the first reference that we can have that meets these criteria. So there. And what's the shock to me is they are Swiss of Italian heritage, one of whom is a ship captain. How that happened, no one knows, who simply is engaged in trade between the Caribbean and New York City, decides New York City is the exciting place. And this, again, is after the Erie Canal is constructed. He says, I got to go to New York. That's the place to be. And so first he opens up a wine shop, and that doesn't do very well. He sells it, goes back, picks up his brother, then comes to New York City, and they open up a small cafe. And that is the beginning of a restaurant empire that will go from 1826 all the way to 1923, almost 100 years. And it will provide the model for restaurants around the United States. And that, to me, was a really exciting story. People have told that well. Mm-hmm. And the documentation there is very, very, very good.
At Delmonico's, there is still a Delmonico's downtown.
Yes, it has no connection with the original one, except the fact that they took the same location for the Delmonic restaurant. And they've done the best they can to remodel the inside of it the way it was when it was a Delmonico's restaurant. So it is a very nice place to go.
And plush, old school.
It's plush, old school. They claim their menu is associated with the types of foods that would have been served in Delmonico's. And so it's well worth going to. And that's something that at least you can see part of New York City past.
Well, then New York got very industrial, and people just didn't have the time to sit down and enjoy a leisurely meal, so they had an alternative way to dine.
All sorts of alternatives. You had lunchrooms and cafeterias, and the descriptions of Europeans in particular watching this, saying people would come in, you would sit at a table with 10 other people, you would order, 2 seconds later the food would arrive, you would consume your food, and 5 minutes later you're gone.
And not even necessarily talk to one another.
Like no, you wouldn't talk with them. And so this shocked upper-class Europeans who came here and took a look at it. But to me, the real exciting end result of all this is the automat. And I've always been in love with automats. And I was what got me interested in New York City food to begin with was the closing of the last
Horn
automat.
Horn and Hardart.
In New York City in 1991. Yeah. And so to me, it was seedy, and I understand why it was closed. But that was part of the culinary heritage of New York City, and it was lost, and I felt badly about that.
Certainly there are other automats around the rest of the country, but I don't know if they still exist
now,
then it was a first.
Now what's the question of an automat? I mean, vending machines are now automats
in some ways.
Because they have all sorts of, not just the candy and snack food anymore, but they actually have hot food, believe it or not, and they have all sorts of diverse types of foods. And so in some ways, the large vending machines meet some of the needs that people have for quick service and just put money in and not worry about it. Mm-hmm. The automats, I just love the idea, and putting a coin in and then getting a piece of pie out and not having to worry about a waitress and not having to worry about a tip. And I mean, you could eat it. And then,
You can see your selection and
your selection before you have to, as opposed to looking at a menu and trying to decide, well, do I want this? Well, then when it comes, ooh, this isn't what I thought it would be. So at least those were some of the advantages.
And it stayed around and it became almost like a museum. People would come and visit it.
It did. And when New York Public Library had a lunch hour exhibition, they had a part of an automat in there. No food inside. I thought that was disappointing. But they tried. And there was an automat on the Lower East Side that tried to survive for a few years. But then it folded when the recession came. So,
You talk about food in New York and some of the things that I was wondering. What really changed the nature of the food that we eat and the food that was served? And certainly we have railway and shipping and the
canals. You have transportation coming in, and so any goods that you want, you can get in New York City. If you want spices, not a problem. They'll be in there, and they can be fresh, by the way, not just the bottled stuff that's been around for years.
Strawberries year round.
If you want strawberries, you can get them. Yeah, for better or worse. I mean, you can get virtually any produce that you want here, there are air shipments coming in on a regular basis. If you don't want to buy locally and you want to buy some product that's from some other place, you can get it. And of course, now the wines that are available in New York City. I mean, you can get almost anything here. So,
well, I think that one something that that whether the shipping of all this fresh produce or not spawned all this, but was the advent of supermarkets. I mean, the suburban sprawl was one thing, but supermarkets
and King Cullen, believe it or not, is at least the Smithsonian recognized it as the first supermarket. Now, there were larger restaurants that actually existed in California, but they weren't called supermarkets. And so this one was, and it popularized the idea. And what surprised me, this opens up in Queens in 1930.
Yeah.
And within a period of 5 years, there are more than 1,000 supermarkets in America. Then within 10 years, there are 7,000 supermarkets. I mean, the idea spread so quickly. And the idea was, historically, if you were going to shop, you'd have to shop daily and pick up your food and then bring it back.
Right, go to the market, fresh markets.
The idea of being a supermarket was you could drive your car. There would be a parking lot there. You could buy the produce and foods that you needed for a week or more. And so you would shop less regularly, and it would be more efficient. And because it was large and because they had a lot of products there, the prices were cheaper. And a large number of mom-and-pop shops went out of business. So that was...
Well, it met the needs of urban, as I said, of suburban sprawl. And actually, for reference, interesting show. I had an interesting guest, Tracy Deutsch, did a show, number 144, if you want to listen. And it was the development of supermarkets, marketing, and all the fancy displays were billed as a housewife's paradise. So. So we could call it a housewife's paradise rather than a supermarket. But that anyway, the first was in New York, that was...
Right. Big. But I mean, the scene has changed a lot, and supermarkets have changed a lot, too. And so Whole Foods, which is an incredible resource for fresh and really good food that's brought in on a very frequent basis, and now the attempt to move into some of the food deserts in New York City, I think there's a lot of really good things that are going on.
So there are – you have a section in the book where you name specific New York dishes, New York dishes such as Manhattan clam chowder.
Yeah, well, there's at least dishes named after or thought to be New York-based,
right.
Yes.
And
like the Manhattan itself, the beverage, yes. Yeah. But there's also a Queens cocktail and there's a Bronx cocktail. I just want you to know.
The Waldorf salad.
All of the boroughs of New York City get some visibility.
They're all there.
They're all there.
What I wanted to do was at the end here, fast forward to present day. Food, how did we get to the point where we are such a food-obsessed nation? I mean, New York has been for a long time, so much so that there are whole cookbooks written devoted to New York food. dozens, as you mentioned there.
Dozens. Yeah. And if you start looking at New York City food writers who write cookbooks, then you're talking thousands. So it's not just about New York City, but obviously New York.
What did you say? Dozens, just about New York food.
Well, certainly many other cities have large numbers of immigrants coming in. New York City by far has the most and the largest numbers. I mean, there's 190 language groups spoken in New York City public schools, and virtually all of them have restaurants or food available that will tap into them. And that diversity just doesn't exist in many other. Certainly, there are lots of diversity in other cities, but not like it is here in New York.
Yeah.
And there's money here, and that's the other thing. You need money, and then because you've got money, you've got skilled chefs coming in from all over the world. From Asia or from Europe or from Latin America and now from Africa. So you've got a real group of professionals that are coming in that are creating new things. And it's that excitement, I think, that's one of the things that interested so many of us, including myself.
Yeah. And it has spread across the country. And I, for one, am very happy that everyone is so enthusiastic about food, wanting to know where it comes from and embracing new types of cooking.
I'm hungry.
Me too. But I am so happy to have this book, New York City, A Food Biography, because it really does chart what was put on the map in terms of what happened in New York. And it's amazing how much started here. Go on.
Two quick things. The first is that this was only a small portion of the material that I had. It's only 70,000 words, and I actually had about 1,000 pages of notes for it. And so I'm delighted to report that Oxford University Press has just contracted out with myself as editor-in-chief and Kathy Kaufman as associate editor for a trade publication encyclopedia-like work called Savoring Gotham. So we will be
food of New York City will be in encyclopedic form.
And beverages, and we're looking for authors, and we're looking for writers. So that will be an open thing we'll be working on over the next couple of
years.
Sure,
well, I certainly look forward to that and participating in it as well.
And we have our the Food Technology Conference.
That's what I wanted to bring up next.
Go.
April 3rd through the 5th. There is the Food Conference.
The Food Conference.
Tell us a little bit about the subject matter of this one.
We decided that technology is so important in food, and so few of us really understand it. And
are afraid of it.
And are afraid of it. And the fears and the efficiency of technology seem to us to be very important. And so we're dealing with a number of very tough issues, including we've got a really good panel on genetically modified food. And we've got panels on historical cooking and on how knives were used. I mean, it's just a whole collection of people. We have, believe it or not, people flying in from Australia. We've got people flying in from Europe, all coming in to talk about technology and food. And it's right here in New York City at the Roger Smith Hotel on April 3rd through 5th.
And if you want to find out more about the food conference, you can go online to thefoodconference.com. There you have it. Andy, always a pleasure to have you on the show. And if people want to know more about New York City food, if they want to see if their favorite food is in the book, I encourage you to pick up a copy of it, and I look forward to the next publication. Thanks for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.